So here's the million-dollar question. How are men like us who work hard, have good motives, and a God-given purpose supposed to fulfill the calling on our lives and the dreams in our hearts, all while establishing sexual integrity, thriving relationships, and a meaningful connection with God? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Sathya Sam. Welcome to Unleash the Man Within. Well, man, this is super exciting. We are kicking off a new segment and something that we've been talking about doing here in the company for what feels like an eternity, probably since we brought you on, Sean. So it's exciting to be here. And Sean, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's giving me flashbacks to being in your house doing a in-person interview.
I know. It's always better in person, or it's better when you have multiple people. So this is going to be a fun segment. Yeah. I'll tell the audience a little bit about what we're doing here. And I've already been kind of prefacing them on it anyway, but, you know, the subject matter that you and I deal with, Sean, in our coaching and our work is rather private and taboo. And, I think there's a lot of confusion and uncertainty about, you know, how to go about some of the challenges that come in a recovery journey or trying to live in better health, better holiness, whatever it might be. So, the goal of these episodes is, you know, I think it's important for Sean and I to be able to catch up, to share some of our wisdom. But then we're really excited to answer your guys' questions and hopefully provide some clarity and some guidance. You know, been really inspired by Dave Ramsey, who for, 35 years has just dominated the airwaves giving financial advice. Mind Pump is a fitness podcast I listen to a lot. They do it there and they really change people's lives. And so I'm excited to change some more lives with this format. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And to the audience listening, thanks for chiming in. And if you have your questions, make sure you are submitting them through our form, because we would love to consider them and we'd love to get you on here and maybe do some coaching with you as well. Sean, the last time we had you on here, you were getting ready to move overseas. You and your wife was pregnant and you guys were getting ready to expand the family. Give us a little update, man. How is life and how are things and what's been going on?
Yeah. Last time it was early May. We ended up leaving Canada on May 30th. So it's been quite the journey since then. Even just that trip to come and see you and even do that in-person interview was quite the ordeal with a really sick wife at home, pregnant with a toddler. So God really used that and honored that. But leaving Canada was quite the experience. You know, people usually travel, maybe they leave for 6 months as you've done with Jamaica, but to really actually be leaving was such a odd feeling. But knowing we were going somewhere that had some familiarity with family, the Czech Republic, where Helena's from, but also at the place where she's had a lot of trauma in her childhood and past. So there was just this really mixture of emotions as we were moving, lots of joy and excitement, but also, what are we doing? Like, this is really crazy, you know, going somewhere brand new. So, you know, update 101 is, you know, Helena is healthy. We gave birth on January 11th to Lydia Daisy Bonito. She's over 6 weeks now. She's very healthy. She's got weight in today. She's at 5 kilos. She gained 2 kilos in the last 6 weeks. So very healthy baby, eating a lot. Violet's birthday was yesterday, so she turned 3 yesterday and just developing into such a sweet young girl. And, you know, that transition definitely has had challenges on her, but I think the you know, what you're saying, like the things that we do in our coaching, in our education, in this industry, seeing childhood trauma, unmet needs, is just given Helen and I a real lens into how to help her cope through these hard things. How do we cope through these hard things? I don't speak Czech, so it's been a language challenge. I had to go through 45 hours of driving lessons to get a license out here. So you can imagine it's just been lots of interesting challenges, but it's been like God confirming one thing after another with somebody who speaks English, exploring Christianity, having a chance to evangelize or disciple, getting a chance to share the gospel with family members, finding an awesome home church, which in Czech is 1% evangelical Christian. That's not easy to find. We're in a very rural area. So just lots of, you know, God's hand in this, God's hands in that, very clear. So, you know, as we see in scripture over and over again, like amidst suffering, amidst trials, amidst challenges, there's always those signs that the Lord is in it. And Sometimes they're super small, but it's been enough for us to cling on for another week, another month. And that's been what's going on for us, man. But yeah, family's growing. I'm a girl dad, 100%, two daughters now.
Yeah, you are.
You know, we got the gamut of the violet flower, we got the daisy flower, we're touching in the biblical name. Right. So we're having a lot of fun. It's been so cool to see, Violet be a big sister. And yeah.
It's funny you're talking about Lydia. So Lydia's at 5 kilograms, she's 6 weeks. So that's a pretty healthy weight. Judah is like this monster child. He's in like the 90th percentile for like everything, head size, weight, length. Yeah. So he's super long. And we were exploring actually, like, people don't know this about Jamaica, but there's actually gorgeous mountain ranges here. Mm-hmm. And so like we were in like hoodies and stuff yesterday. Like you're way up and it's cold. But it's beautiful, like breathtaking views. And so we went out there with some friends of ours who just had their fourth, they're our age. They just had their fourth kid. And their son is 22 months and Judah is four and a little bit.
Yeah.
And they're almost the same size. Like Judah's almost as long as he is. And he weighs about 3 or 4 pounds less. Like,
incredible.
It's just. It's just crazy. And it's not my genes. I'm like skin and bones. You know what I mean? It's all my wife's side. My father-in-law is like a pretty imposing guy. He's a big dude. And it looks like Judah got most of that gene pool. That's kind of crazy.
Dude, it's incredible to see how, every kid can be so different. It's not one better than the other. It's just like, that's so cool to see, God's kind of fingerprint on each kid in genetics, how they can string to grandparents and skip parents. Like, Violet's a pretty tall girl at three. It's like, I'm not tall. Helena's not tall.
Interesting.
We see that it must be coming from Helena's dad because he's pretty tall. So yeah, we can see that too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of funny how it works. So what's the adjustment been like to two kids? Because I know Shaloma and I were talking actually yesterday again, because we're watching our friends, right? There's two of them. There's the two parents and then there's double the amount of kids, right? So it's just hilarious. And the kids are really well behaved, actually. Like, to their credit, they're a beautiful family. Yeah. But so interesting because, like, Shaloma can pass them over to me and she can go enjoy herself a little bit. And, you just slowly relinquish all your freedoms as an adult. Like, we spent our whole childhood trying to become free. Yeah. And we have kids of our own and we lose all the freedom all over again. So what's that adjustment been like for you guys?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good point. Helena's awesome. She's a great mom in general, but she's really awesome in the nurture stage, like in the newborn stage. She just really rocks it. It's like God has gifted her in that realm. So she has done such a good job, even like with the challenges with sleep and whatnot. So the adjustment for her has definitely just been there's just less time for her unless I'm home. So that has been obviously the main adjustment, as you're saying, like more kids than two kids, two hands. And you got to cook, you got to clean, you got to do things. So I think the main adjustment that's been on our mind a lot lately is, laundry can wait. There's like that urge in you to get those sorts of things done. So you have a nice clean home, but you realize that it's just not that big of a priority when you have a baby who needs to eat and you have a toddler who needs attunement. So that's been the big adjustment, is really seeing how valuable and also fragile Violet's needs are with attunement and engagement, how easy it is to assume that she would just see that, mommy's busy with Lydia and needs to feed her. And, she would just grasp that idea, which at three, obviously she doesn't. So it's been the adjustment of how to communicate with her really clearly of how she must be feeling when mommy says that she's going to play with her and then ends up isn't able to because Lydia needs to feed. So that's been the big adjustment is Violet, obviously had all of our attention before. And if we weren't giving her attention, it's because we all needed some quiet time and alone time. But now it's like there's another human taking that attention. And it can be very aggressive at times where it's like, whoa, she went from 0 to 10 really quick. And there's not even really a moment for Violet to understand what just happened other than Lydia's more important. So that's been the big adjustment, is for us to really communicate with Violet and let her communicate how she's been feeling. So she's been really good at expressing her emotions. So the adjustment of fielding those, sitting with them, she's obviously three, so she's communicating that more clearly now. So it's pretty profound at three how smart this kid is. I think kids in general are. It's really incredible.
Yeah, you guys are so good at that though. Like, you guys have been really intentional in your marriage about having that kind of emotional language and having those conversations and, you know, giving space for each other. And it's cool to see that trickle down now into your kids and, you know, creating that safety for Violet. You mentioned attunement, which I think it'd be interesting to actually talk about that a little bit more, because the one thing we do observe in our clients, you know, when we're pinpointing traumas or even just like dynamics, you know, within the self, within relationships, this attunement thing is a pretty big deal, because I know even for me, like in my recovery, one of my huge discoveries was the reason I pursued women and pornography and sought all that is actually because of a lack of attunement that was taking place at home. And not that my mom was neglectful or anything like that. There was just that, you know, kind of that dissociation. And my wife and I have been talking about this, because Judah, as soon as we have the phone in our hands, Judah's like very aware of sort of like the divide between attention, right? Or sort of the competition. And so we've been talking a bit about that. And I, again, like Shaloma and I are not really phone junkies, you know, like my screen time averages like an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours a day max. And that's mostly work related or workout related. So it's not, it's not like we're always on the phone, but even just to grab it for a couple minutes, or even if we're just taking a video of him, like he's all of a sudden, like you can just tell, you can see the difference, right? So how did like that attunement, I guess all is to say is that attunement thing's a big deal. I think it's cool you guys are so conscious of it with Violet.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I really appreciate that, man. We've known each other long enough where you've been able to see that, and it's neat to be consistent, which, you know, we talk a lot about consistency is what kids really need more than this idea of perfection, which is obviously unattainable. So that's that attunement idea is like, even today, you know, I was playing with Violet for like an hour when Helena took Lydia to an appointment. And then when Helena got home and there was a couple of things I needed to do to get ready for work. And Violet was kind of, you know, protesting that, she, you know, I would still play with her. And it was like, hey, you know, we just played for an hour together. I can see that that's bothering you. I can understand that we, you know, you want to play with daddy, but hey, what if we had some alone time? You got this toy, you got that toy. What would it look like to have some time to play by yourself and learn that independence further? But acknowledging like, hey, you want to play with daddy? That's awesome. But daddy has some things to do, rather than just saying, hey, you know, like whatever, like we played for an hour, you should be grateful. Like that's such an easy response to have. And there's definitely times where it gets to the place where I have to remind her that she needs to be grateful, and she is a really, really, really blessed girl, but it certainly can't start with that.
Right. Which usually it does.
Which they don't understand that she's three.
Yeah, it's interesting. Man, I'm going to need to send this episode to my wife, because we, I feel like we had these conversations a lot. Like this is something, I don't know if you've, we haven't talked about this before, so I don't know if this is something you've dealt with. But, you know, our generation is very aware of like, okay, things from our past, parent dynamics, parent philosophies, the way we were disciplined, the way we were nurtured impacts us, you know, and there's, that's been really, I think, liberating for our generation to be able to say, okay, you know, mom and dad didn't do everything right. And here's how it affected me, and I'm healing from it. I'm growing. There's the dark side of that, which is my life would have been perfect if not for my mom and dad and their you know, shortcomings, which is obviously like, you know, that's not correct at all. Not the right attitude. And I think the other side of it, and my wife and I have both experienced this, is like, oh man, I hope I don't mess up my kids. You know, like it can kind of plant that like, I don't know, insecurity or that paranoia. And I remember I was talking to Jeff Stewart. We interviewed him a couple times on the show, and I asked him what he thought about it. And he was like, man, it's just all about rupture and repair. You're gonna mess things up. You know, it's gonna come short at some point. But what matters more is, are you repairing it, and how are you repairing it? So that was just such a good example you gave of like, there's that rupture. I don't even know if I would call that a rupture, but you know, just like something that requires a bit of repair and providing that perspective and doing it in a nurturing way. So you guys have to write a book or something, man. I think
one day. Thanks, bro. I appreciate it. The rupture and repair. I was going to share that if that wasn't where you were going, because that's such a big part of everything we do. And it's just been special to see, to hear Violet say, you know, mommy, I miss you. You know, Lydia's taking time and I miss you, and being able to hold that and say, that's okay to feel that way. Yeah. Like I am gone more than I used to be. That must be really hard. What can we do right now to help you feel safe now? Right. And helping her learn that we can do things now. We can talk about those things. So it's just been really special.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. So how great does it feel to finally be able to drive on your own in the Czech, man? Because you had to wait so long to get your license.
It feels amazing. It's funny, a lot of people will say, and I had this thought at first, like, oh, I can't believe you can't just, transfer your license. There's definitely enough differences driving here that I'm glad that I had to take some driving lessons. I think it was overkill on how much I had to do, but I am glad. And now that I've gone through all of that, it actually makes it even sweeter because I not just feel like I'm able to drive, but I actually do feel like I'm able to drive safely as, as a father. So it's just been so sweet, man. Like, we live 20 minutes from the nearest city, which is 20,000 people. So not a huge city, but to be able to have a coffee with a friend from church now, go into the city and go for coffee or, go get groceries so it doesn't take 4 hours with two kids, like go and do those things for my family. I get to drive to work now when it's raining. Like, all those little things that really do add up. So it has been really, really sweet. And, it's just a beautiful country. So even just driving around the rural areas, it's just gorgeous. It just feels fun.
Well, yeah, you're in a gorgeous area. Like, it would be a travesty to not have a car out there and be able to explore.
Absolutely. Yeah, the trains are awesome, but always better to have the car.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Driving is such an interest. Like, it's interesting how tied in it is to like leadership and family and feeling like you can, I don't know, have some sort of assertion. I don't know. It's kind of weird. 'Cause I know for me, like, and as funny as you're talking about the driving school, I was like, yeah, they should probably have that in Jamaica, 'cause driving in Jamaica is just absolutely crazy. Like, there's nothing like it. And I'm very used to it now. But, there's no such thing as rules of the road here. Like, there's suggestions of the road and they're lightly followed, right? So it's crazy. So you're just on your toes all the time, man. It's kind of crazy. But yesterday when we were driving, so to get up to this mountain peak where we drove, it is like a crazy drive. And you drive through like this Jamaican military base, and it's windy roads, and you're making turns, and sometimes you don't even know what's around the corner until you've made the turn. And then Jamaica has like potholes everywhere, right? Like, the roads aren't as developed or maintained. So like, sometimes like the road in theory would be fine to drive on, but because you're dodging the pothole, but then if you go too far over, your car will literally start to go over the cliff. Like, it's, you're kind of like driving crazy. And then like this huge Mack truck will be coming down the other way, like just randomly, because they were dropping off supplies at like the there was the army base, I think, yesterday. So then you have to back up, and you have to like go up onto the shoulder and try to leave room, and like, it's bonkers. And my wife was really frustrated with Judah at one point, so she was like, "Oh, she's like, I should have driven so that you could be back here with him." And I was like, "Babe, trust me, I know that taking care of Judah is probably a super big pain in the butt. You do not want to be driving right now. Like, it is just crazy." So I'm always like so grateful I can drive here. It's
No,
also on the other side of the road, so it's
ah,
like, you just, I mean, I'm used to that now. Like, I hop in the car here and I don't even really think about it. But yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, man. It's kind of crazy.
yeah. Was that your guys' first time driving up that mountain?
We've done it. We've done most of that mountain before, but we went a lot further up this time. So yeah, there was some uncharted territory this
Yeah,
time.
with a baby.
With a baby, yeah, with a baby. And like, Judah's great, as in he doesn't mind it, but he's a really alert kid. So he's just not sleeping when like the car's bumping and rocking around and you're making these crazy, 160 degree turns and all that stuff. So
Yeah,
yeah.
man. Yeah. Violet was certainly not a lover of the car seat, so there is lots of car challenges, so we can empathize.
So look, we're gonna get into some questions here in just a minute. But Sean, I'd love for you to share maybe something that you're observing in the clients we've been working with. Any trends or anything that you think has been interesting in people in their recovery journeys?
Yeah, man. I think the thing that always stands out, and I think you just had a podcast on it just not that long ago, but just the reality of how like eye-opening it is for guys to explore the inner child inside, or whatever we call parts work. It's just so groundbreaking. I was even talking to a client earlier today who is he's a teacher. I can't remember what age he teaches. Like, I think it's younger kids, let's say 10. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's just that reminder of how do you talk to your students? You know, what if you began to, instead of this inner critic talking to you as if you're an adult, what if it was more of a conversation with those younger parts of you that when you're 8, when you were 10 and this happened, that happened, you know, it just will change the dynamic of how you talk to yourself, how you experience Jesus, and you will, you know, over, let's say, you know, let's say you do that for 30 days, you won't be the same person. You just naturally can't be the same person when you attune and tend to those sensitive areas with like what you would do to a 8-year-old child going through a challenging thing. So that's just been really rocking, guys, because that's that multifaceted. It's the trauma element, it's the gospel spiritual element, it affects the nervous system and the physiological element. So that's just been profound. And that's just one of my favorite things to talk about is all of that as well. So not only is it one of my favorite things, but it's been just constantly profound with clients over and over again. So that's what I've been going through a lot lately with guys, just hammering that down and just having those aha moments and breakthroughs.
It's so good, man. It's so good. Yeah. Maybe next week's episode, we'll hit on that a little bit more. Yeah. Some of the inner child stuff, the inner critic or the inner voice. There's some good stuff there. Let's tackle some questions. I'm excited to get into this. You guys are going to hear one extra voice on here, and that is Oscar, our ops production man extraordinaire. And so Oscar's going to be reading off some questions here, and let's jump in. You ready for us, Oscar?
Question one is from Austin, Texas. I've been addicted to porn since grade 7, now in sophomore in college, and I've been actively trying to quit for the last 2 years. I've come to realize that the root issue for me is lack of intimacy and also the belief that I don't deserve or don't have what it takes to get real intimacy. So I keep turning to the knockoff. My problem is that I will go about 2 weeks without temptation. The thought of pornography will hardly ever come up. Then I will get the urge, and after fighting it for a couple of days, I give in. I call friends, pray, check every box that I've been told to do. And most of the time, I'm tempted in the evening when I'm about to take a shower. Because when I was younger, I would sneak into the shower to watch porn. So I keep getting tempted there. Or if I see something accidentally on social media that will trigger me. Any advice on what to do after being triggered? Or if I get tempted from an environmental factor like the shower?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it definitely points out that you can be triggered by just about anything and in just about any environment. So there's always two things when it comes to triggers. One is that you want to be able to have some strategies in the moment. Dr. Trish Lee would call it like a trigger plan, because it will happen. And then you also want to be thinking a little bit more about what's causing it and seeing if there's things you can do to prevent it. So especially if something's occurring frequently, like if it always happens in the shower, that's a good thing to dig into. Sean, I'll let you tackle that, but I'll talk about the trigger strategies.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of things. Number one is it's always good if you're in the shower or something like that. I think in general, like, you can be paying attention to the stimulation that's going on in the shower, because it's funny what guys start to do with their thoughts and also even with their hands sometimes when you're in a bit more of a free environment. So that's the first thing I'd be paying attention to. Second thing is the easiest way to dissipate any kind of trigger is your breathing. So the quicker you can take control of your breath, the faster you can re-engage those prefrontal structures of your brain that are going to make better decisions. And I think that can go a long way. And then the last thing I would say, I always had a mantra, or like it was a little piece of scripture, a little proverb, something that would just redirect my thoughts. And I still have it, actually. And that's a great example of what a trigger plan could be. Where it's like, sometimes trigger plans are like, you know, I need to go play the guitar. And it's like, well, you're not going to do that mid shower, you know? A better trigger plan sometimes is actually just something you can do cerebrally that allows you to just to kind of get your thoughts back on track. So those would be the main things I'd be thinking of if you're observing that pattern or kind of being triggered at random. But the trigger plan or how you're going to go about this, the strategy, it has to be premeditated. That's the key. You don't have the mental energy to think about what am I going to do and how am I going to go about this in the moment. You have to be able to act on it right away. And some of the research would suggest that from when you're triggered to whether or not it leads you down, you know, a good path or a not so good path is about a 3-second window. That's pretty small. So you don't want to be forced to make any decisions. You just want to have it predetermined that when I'm triggered, here's what I'm going to do. And I'll actually just add one last thing, a little extra credit here, which is that for me, I could spend days in the shower. Like, I don't know what it is. I get there, my mind wanders. I am off in La La Land. And it was starting to become a bit of a problem where it was like, number one, the showers are just way too long and we got bills to pay, you know, that kind of thing. But then there's the other side of it, which is like, hey, you know, why, what is happening in the shower? That's a lot. That's just causing me to like basically dissociate, you know, and kind of tune out. And so I actually started to like take cold showers. I started to be a little bit more intentional, even about my shower length. So that it was like, I'm here to soap, I'm here to shampoo, and I'm out, you know, and being a little bit more intentional about that was actually helpful for me. That wasn't even necessarily in the realm of relapses and triggers. But it would still be relevant, which is that if you're a little bit more intentional, and if you do shock your body with a cold shower or something like that, that'll probably snap you back into action pretty quickly and keep you on agenda. So that's what I'd be recommending on kind of the front end there. Sean, what are some things you can be doing maybe on the back end?
Yeah, great stuff. So, you know, the trigger plan, you know, tying kind of into the nervous system. I'll just keep it really simple and kind of tie into that same idea. When I talk about the nervous system, I kind of talk about the green zone is where we feel safe, we feel secure. It's where we have those, you know, the prefrontal cortex parts of the brain, the frontal lobes firing, so we make good decisions, but we just don't spend a lot of time there. And one of the things that takes us away from those safe places, at least mental spaces, is usually perception. So, you know, where do we have perceptions of danger, perceptions of fear? And it's very common where we get those programmed into us. So why that's important is because it sends us into our past reflection to say, what was it like growing up where maybe there was a danger in my household, there was a danger going on in school, there was a danger in my life. And I'm not talking about like physical danger necessarily. It could be rejection. It could have been insecurity. It could have been some sort of abuse. But we want to look at like what caused the shower to be maybe a symbol of comfort, a place where you went to it for escape. What was going on in that season where that became a stronghold, that became an addiction? We want to go back and say, why did the shower become such a place of comfort? Because if we can do that, we can actually reclaim it as it is a place of comfort, but your usage of it actually isn't real comfort. So we want to do that because it helps us define, like, I use it as false pleasure. But like for me, I actually have showers and long hot baths as a place of pleasure. That's where I find soothing and comfort. When I'm stressed, that's where I go. And when guys use it for the other, you know, the complete opposite, it's fascinating, right? Like Sophia, you're saying, like, you would find yourself in a shower and you get lost in thought. You know, there's obviously things there too, but that'd be the first thing I say. Second thing is like, what we want to start doing is, and kind of going back into that predetermined game plan, is we actually want to ask ourselves, like, what are the things that make us feel safe, make us feel calm, actually help us experience real pleasure? And if it's hard to pinpoint that, it's probably an indicator that maybe growing up, we were never taught how to really care for ourselves. Maybe we didn't see it modeled. And why that's important is we want to be able to open the door, open the lens to see, where did my parents maybe neglect things that I needed to be taught? Where did I miss things growing up in life? And we begin to see that that's why things like porn and masturbation become so powerful, is because they fill those voids. When somebody isn't leading us, porn will come in and take over. When we are lacking friendships, porn will come over and take over. When we feel powerless, we'll go to porn to feel power. There's all these things we do. So it doesn't matter if it's in the shower or in the bedroom, there's always similarities. And it usually ties back to a formative time where the shower or the bedroom or whatever else it is became a tie, where loneliness got tied to arousal. And then that became a symbol or an idol. Anger got tied to arousal, and that became what we call eroticized rage. So there's a lot that can be combined with that trigger plan. So to keep it really simple for you, you can kind of put those together and say, what's my trigger plan? But then also, why is the shower a place of escape? What's the symbolism there? What dangers are happening in my life that make me run to the shower as a place of safety, and things along those lines? And that's where we start getting into inner child work. That's where we start getting into deeper healing work, pinpointing traumas and doing some more therapeutic exercises. So we don't want to go too deep, because that's a lot to do on your own. So that trigger plan, and then starting to explore when and where did this start, I think would be great for you to build a foundation to do some deeper healing.
Question 2 is from Dean in Birmingham, USA. From an addiction standpoint, We've been lying, hiding, covering our tracks, and so many other things. When you want recovery, you're trying to turn everything around. How do you understand concepts like truth and intimacy when you're conditioned yourself to view them as something they aren't, such as white lies?
That's a great question. And just so that the audience knows, Oscar's originally from Sweden. So if you notice him trying to figure out the state abbreviations, that's what's going on there. Even me sometimes, sometimes being in Canada, you know, I'm still getting familiar with some of these. So well done, man. You're crushing it here. I think there's two parts to this. Number one is when you are in recovery and you're ditching an old lifestyle, you're ditching an old addiction. The reality is it's going to take time. So yes, you have definitely done some conditioning to lie, to distort, all that kind of stuff. I think the other side of it though is, and this is where like scripture and some of these spiritual concepts become really important, which is that we're actually new creations and it's in our nature to experience intimacy and to experience truth. And, you know, I kind of liken us to, you know, we're that perfectly sculpted David in that block of marble. And when Michelangelo did that sculpture, you know, it was a masterpiece. It was revolutionary. We still talk about it hundreds of years later. And when he was asked about, you know, how did you come up with it? All he said was like, the David was in that block of marble all along. Mm-hmm. I just had to release him. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is important. It's not about like trying to understand truth and intimacy. I think we actually all inherently know what those things are, or we at least know when we're not getting them the way that they're supposed to. And so for starters, I would encourage a paradigm shift there, which is that it is actually in your nature to tell the truth. It's actually in your nature to experience intimacy. And we want to start there. We want to start on offense, because otherwise we play defense the whole time and it's really, really hard to get ahead and it actually becomes really frustrating. I would say the second step, like when I think about myself, you know, I got really good at hiding my addiction, got really good at kind of putting on the front. And I had to sort of learn how to be really transparent with other dudes in particular. That was really uncomfortable. I still remember the first time I even talked about my struggle with pornography in a group of guys. And then as those conversations developed, it was starting to get even more specific and more detailed. It was actually really helpful, but that was a muscle I had to exercise. And I would say that is the key to, you know, that kind of truth and intimacy piece you're talking about, is learning to practice vulnerability. And it's not, this is like classic guy brain. So guys hear that and then they go and they try to be super vulnerable as quickly as possible. And that's very similar to like yo-yo dieting, you know, in the fitness industry, where it's like you can get a little jolt of it of like, wow, I was vulnerable and I got all this stuff off my chest. But it's actually the active, steady, consistent practice of just being transparent, being open, being vulnerable. That's what you kind of want to work on. And it's sort of like the get like 1% better one day at a time. So that'd be my two recommendations. Number one is you got to understand your identity. Your nature is to actually walk in truth and intimacy. And we're just peeling back the layers of marble that are kind of interfering with that. And the second part is you don't peel back all the layers of that marble overnight. It's literally just shaving a bit here, a bit there. And little by little, that David starts to emerge with a lot more clarity and resolution.
Mm-hmm. Good. Really good. Yeah, I would just piggyback off that a bit. And yeah, like we do often know, we pretty much every time we do understand the concept of like, this is actually what's true. The challenge for most guys is I'm afraid to actually take action and do it. You know, scripture talks a lot about it's knowledge and understanding that leads to our confidence. And it's like, we can choose to live in that confidence, or we can choose to kind of say, you know, I don't know if I really believe that. I don't know if I really believe that. I believe that's a choice, right? There's the gospel. There's one gospel of Jesus Christ, and we can choose to live fully in it and feel confident, or we can choose to wonder, is that for me? Is that really available for me? It is. Like, if we just really understand it and grasp it, it's scripture says it leads to confidence. That's what develops our character. That's what leads to hope. That's what leads to action. So I think a lot of this is, I think we were talking in the staff meeting not that long ago, Sophia, the habitual courage, right? These are those times where it calls us to have habitual courage to say, I do understand it intellectually because this actually is truth and it makes sense, but every fiber of my being is pretty scared right now, but this is what's truth and Jesus is with me. So I'm going to take this risk because it's calculated and I'm going to learn from it. I'm going to grow from it. I think that's how we grow past those conditionings and recondition ourselves.
Yeah. And it is sort of the great irony of addiction is addictions are developed typically because we're seeking comfort in something.
Yeah.
And to break out of that addiction cycle, you actually have to do something really uncomfortable. Yeah. And so that's an important part. Like, it's not easy, you know, and it's not always comfortable and enjoyable. But if you're willing to do those things, and even if it's just a small bit at a time, those things really start to stack up and they go a long way. So this is a really good question. This tells me that, you know, Dean, you know, if you're asking this, your heart's in the right place. Yeah. You know, you clearly have a value for truth and intimacy. So everything's there, you know, it's just, now you just need to kind of take some action like Sean's talking about. And stop putting yourself in the dumps, you know, don't need to kick yourself down. We've all made our mistakes. We've all fallen short, but now you get a chance to step into your new nature and build some new habits there, man. So we're cheering you on.
Question three is from Noah, Quinton, Alabama. I was led through deliverance and I felt like my life was changed. I was relapsing almost daily up until that point. But in the last 2 weeks, I've only had 2 relapses. It's definitely an improvement, but why didn't it completely help me eliminate the relapses?
Yeah, Noah, what's up, man? I'm pretty sure I know Noah. I think we've chatted before. This is such a good question. I have a very unpopular opinion about deliverance for a charismatic guy, which is that I think deliverance should be done really carefully. Yeah. And I think that a lot of times we jump into deliverance prematurely. Mm. And the scripture even Jesus talked about how when a demon's cast out, it searches waterless places and returns back with 7 more. And if it sees that the house is in order, it'll inhabit it. You know, it's really just fascinating, a fascinating concept. But the basic idea here is the house. Sorry, I think I might have misquoted that. If the house is not in order, mm-hmm. it'll inhabit it.
There we go. We got it.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. So there's good information here, which is that we don't just want to cast demons out, but the house actually has to be in order. Because if the house being the inner life, the heart of a person, if the heart is not healthy and whole, it can't actually sustain the deliverance. Yeah. And so I think you know, Noah, what you're experiencing here, this is a really good example where, it sounds like the demons were cast out. That's fantastic. But there might still be some holes in the foundation that need to be taken care of first before you can actually sustain it. You know, another great example, I had a neighbor. This was back when I was an associate pastor. But my neighbor was a terrible smoker, business owner, lots of stress, you know, young kids, and had smoked since he was a teenager. And one day at Bible study, somebody said, you know, I think I'm supposed to pray for Jim, you know, pray for Jim and pray that he doesn't turn to cigarettes anymore. And Jim had been sharing with the group about how he really wanted to quit. And so they laid hands on him and literally, I mean, he was delivered in an instant. I mean, no cravings for weeks. So this was not, you can't conjure that up. You know what I mean? Like anybody who's done cigarettes knows, like, sure, you can kid yourself for a couple of days, but not weeks, not when you're doing a pack a day for years. Then little by little, you know, a little cigarette here, a little cigarette there, and he's back into it. Mm-hmm. And when I asked him about it, he said, you know what, my environment didn't change enough. You know, like, he's still working with the same dudes who take their smoke breaks. So there's a social element, you know, and all those kinds of things. So I think the point here, Noah, is, we don't want to discount the deliverance work, because I'm a big fan of it. I just want to see deliverance works be sustained. And so to me, this is probably an indicator that some of the roots that are at play here have not been fully addressed. And until they are, you can get all the deliverance prayers that you want, but there's still going to be room. They're still going to have access points because the heart has not healed enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good, man. I saw that on the note, the doc earlier, and I was thinking about that question, and my answer in my head was exactly the same. So that's really great. I think, I don't know if I've heard it from you, Sathya, or if I heard it through maybe some of the stuff that I've done, but that idea of stewarding that deliverance is really, really valuable. I did a week long, like intense retreat, restoring the foundations, which is like, you know, breaking generational curses, soul ties, negative core beliefs, all that stuff. And it was great, but it wasn't like this instant change in my heart. It was like a revelation for me to start seeing life differently and start to replace lies with truth that, just naturally, maybe I was just about to become a father. So there was some new things seeping in. And it was this journey I went on for, I don't know, let's say the next 6 months, where everything I learned in that week became a daily habit of letting those core beliefs seep into me more and more. And that now that's my core belief system. I don't have to recite them anymore, but I was able to steward some of that. I don't know if I would call it what I had deliverance, but it certainly was breaking of soul ties and incredible. Sometimes when we think about deliverance, guys are thinking about like demons getting ripped out of them and stuff. I think it's good to have the
comment at the mouth.
Yeah. Like I'm not of the nature that I don't think porn is a demon. Some people do, like the demon of lust. Like there's different opinions on that, but that's not what we're getting into. But I think what you said is perfect, man. Like that idea, we need to cover up the holes that, you know, if you relapse twice in the last 2 weeks, there's some things still there that the Lord wants to highlight. And that's a beautiful gift that he wants to highlight, though, is you get to heal more.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think there's a very strong demonic element to pornography in the industry. And, you know, I even remember like some of the content I used to watch, and you can kind of feel the darkness, right? Yeah. And sometimes that's maybe more reflective of whatever, the people involved or the way something was produced. Because that's even just true of video content in general, like movies and TV shows and stuff like that. Sometimes you can feel like there's something strange behind it. But I would say, Noah, you're on the right track. But your big challenge now is to not go back and get another deliverance prayer. Your challenge is to figure out where are the cracks in the foundation and what's going to be required to patch those things up. And those are the things that we're talking about on the show here, you know, getting to the roots, doing the inner child work, trigger plans. Those are things we've just talked about today, but there's tons of other elements that are probably going to help you get your heart in order, get the house in order, if you will. So that, you know, for me, like I'm a lot more of the opinion now that if you get healthy enough, the demons just suffocate, you know? And like, I think that need to do like a big boisterous kind of deliverance. I still have a value for it. Truthfully, I don't mind it at all. I'm not against it, but I also have observed guys who, you know, probably had some oppression or had some, you know, some not so stuff going on there on a spiritual level. But as they got healthier, as they healed up, they do their inner child work, they start to become more Christ-like. Like eventually, like what's going to happen if you become more Christ-like? Obviously, the demonic has to flee. And that's just a natural byproduct. So that's where I'd be channeling my energy. Thank you guys so much for listening to this first version of this episode format that we're testing out here. I want to make one special ask, which is that if you did enjoy this, there's two things you can do to help us. Number one is share it with other people. We're going to pay attention to the analytics. So if you guys don't like this, we're not going to keep doing it. You know, we're not going to bore you guys. But if you do like it and you share it, that lets us know like, okay, there's something here and this is valuable for you and we'll keep doing more of it. And that's a promise. We will do more of it than more than just once a week. And the second thing is if you have a question, you know, you want these answered. Like I said, if we get some momentum here, we'll start doing these coaching sessions live or answering the questions live. And so if you have questions, you want some answers, there's a form in the show notes, the link's there. Submit your questions. We love to answer them. In the meantime, God bless you guys. Stay clean, and we'll see you soon. Hey, everybody. It's Sathya again. Thanks for listening to Unleash the Man Within. I wanted to take a quick moment to let you know about a free ebook that I wrote for you called The Ultimate Guide to Porn Recovery. It provides a basic framework for the recovery process and a few of my top tips completely free of charge. You can get it now at www.ultimaterecoveryguide.com. That's www.ultimaterecoveryguide.com. Now, if you've been impacted by the podcast and you want to show some support in less than 60 seconds, there are three ways you can do that. First, you can leave a rating or review on your podcast platform. This lets people like you know that the content here is valuable. Secondly, you can share this episode with someone in your life that might benefit from the content. If you're passionate about helping other people experience freedom and success in their lives, this is one of the easiest ways to do that. And lastly, you can subscribe.
I personally only listen to the podcasts that I subscribe to. If you're seeking daily encouragement, guidance, and insight in your recovery journey, I highly recommend subscribing to Unleash the Man Within. Thanks for listening. I look forward to connecting with you very, very soon.
The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast by Sathya Sam and his guests are for general information only and should not be considered medical, clinical, or any other form of professional advice. Any reliance on the information provided is done at your own risk.